Welcome to CFRI Cystic Fibrosis Community Voices, a video podcast series created by and for the cystic fibrosis community.
Hello, and welcome to CFRI's CF Community Voices, coming to you from our home studio in Palo Alto, California. I'm Sue Landgraf, Executive Director of Cystic Fibrosis Research Incorporated, CFRI, and I'm very pleased to welcome our viewers and listeners. We have a very special program ahead, but before getting started, I want to thank our generous sponsors, Vertex Pharmaceuticals, Chiesa USA, Gilead Sciences, Genentech, and Proteostasis Therapeutics. I also would like to note that no information presented in this podcast is intended for a patient's diagnosis or treatment. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. Thank you, and let's get started.
So we're actually early, so I'm going to try and really talk slowly. No, just kidding. I'm actually known for talking pretty fast and going through my slides really quickly, so they always say like, oh, you know, you only have 30 minutes now. It's like, okay, I can fit it in. But today we're going to be very mindful about trying to do this, since we are talking about mind-body therapies and CF care. Everyone's kind of started off the last day and a half or so with starting how they got into being interested in CF or taking care of patients with CF and families, so I'll give you my little blurb. I went to medical school in Kansas at the University of Kansas and did my training at Children's Mercy Hospital, which is a big children's hospital in Kansas City, Missouri. And at that time, there was no pediatric pulmonologist in all of Kansas City area for pediatrics, and so over 2 million people peds pulmonary. So CF at my institution was taken care of by infectious disease and GI together. So it was a kind of a combined therapy. So what I thought I would do is I would go off and learn how to take care of CF and become a pediatric pulmonologist. And then I'd come back and I would be the first and only pediatric pulmonologist and grow the program in Kansas City. Well, I went off to Rochester, New York, but I never went back to Kansas City. But in Rochester, I actually was fortunate to work with a physician named Robert Schwartz, who did his NIH training in the early 60s with Paul Desanonis, who many of you already heard of, has been really one of the very initial founders of CF and described the disease along with Dorothy Anderson back in the 40s. So I felt like I really had a strong interest in this. And what Bob Schwartz told me back then is that, much of what you've already heard, is that sometimes it doesn't matter which things you culture out. Sometimes it doesn't matter which therapies that you actually use. Sometimes it really doesn't matter about kind of how you kind of make things work or not work. It had to do more with kind of how you care about patients and how you care about families. And that's kind of like the theme of my talk today. So then after Rochester, I ended up coming out to California in the mid-80s, and I was a co-director of the CF Center at UC Davis for a couple of years, and then I decided to move to the Central Coast of California and kind of left academic medicine for a number of years. And there, though, I did outreach clinics for UCSF and Stanford. I kind of, one day I put on my Stanford hat, the next day I put on my UCSF hat. And I saw a lot of patients who lived in the Central Coast area for those 15 years. And then in 1999, I had a chance to go down to the University of Arizona and actually do a two-year fellowship with Andrew Weil, learning about alternative therapies, because if you live on the Central Coast of California, that's what everyone uses. I mean, they would come in to see me after their acupuncture didn't work, after the homeopathic remedies didn't work, after their chiropractic massage therapy wasn't working very well, and they would reluctantly say, like, I guess we could try antibiotics. We could try some of these asthma therapies. But so then I had a chance to go to Arizona and actually learn about them. Because we were never really taught much about these in medical school and other conventional areas. So I became there for a couple of years, and then I kind of got back into academic medicine by enjoying the faculty there at University of Arizona, the Tucson Respiratory Center, which is very rich in their tradition of taking care of patients with cystic fibrosis, especially under the leadership of Wayne Morgan. And then I came back to Stanford about 12 years ago, and I've been at Stanford now since that time. And have developed this kind of non-conventional or kind of the it's not really non-conventional, it's kind of more like what people just don't talk about too much when you go to see your practitioners. Like, you talk about nutrition, but you mostly just talk about calories, but really what kind of calories? You talk about stress, but really, do you really talk about stress? You talk about different types of therapies that maybe you heard about by your neighbor, your cousin, or your aunt, or your next door neighbor telling you, like, you should try this, it makes a big difference. Well, how do you know if that's really true or not? So I've kind of gotten into being kind of a resource for a lot of these types of families and these types of patients. This is actually one of my most, the part that I'm interested in most is it actually has to do with mind-body therapies, because I don't have to worry about going to the health food store and finding out whether the supplement really has what it says in it or not, because this is actually in your mind. So I know what's in your mind. I don't have to go through any quality assurance or any type of thing to try to ensure that things are really there, because it's all inside of you. So really, it's mind-body therapy. So really not even considered to be a complementary alternative anymore, because it's actually been shown to be studied over the last 50 years to be very, very strong in so many areas. And so this morning, we're just going to review some of these areas. When you think about it, everybody has a different idea about what these therapies might be, but actually it's a large group that encompasses many things that's been studied in some areas in cystic fibrosis. So the objective really is to, what is the difference between complementary alternative medicine and what I call integrated medicine, which is what I practice, and we'll talk about that. Which chemotherapies are commonly used? Which ones are used by cystic fibrosis patients? And what's the role of mind-body therapies in the care of cystic fibrosis? And should mind-body therapies be considered alternative, or actually should they be mainstay? Maybe everyone should be doing this, just like everyone should have Karen in their clinic doing their PT, which I think we should at Stanford for sure after I heard her talk yesterday. So the National Center for Alternative Integrated Health is a new NIH group that actually sponsors these. It used to be called NCAM, National Center for Complementary Alternative Medicine, but they changed it now to Alternative Integrative Health because they wanted to talk about this integrative approach. So complementary health approaches include an array of modalities and products with a history outside of conventional Western medicine. So you know, like herbal remedies is a good example. Chinese medicine is another example. Ayurvedic medicine, homeopathic, naturopathic, all these things are things that are taught or used outside of conventional Western medicine. Previous studies have shown that individuals who use complementary health approaches to health and well-being or to relieve symptoms associated with chronic disease or side effects is actually very common. I think what really is important is that most people who use these type of health approaches use them complementary to their conventional approaches. So it's not like people are using them instead of. People actually use them in addition to. I keep hitting this flower, sorry. And they had a recent study of over almost 90,000 adults 18 and older was recently published to see just what the incidence is. And this was done by this NCAIH. There's been a little bit of a shift in 2002, 2007, and 2012. But non-vitamin, non-mineral dietary supplements continue to be the most commonly used complementary health approach at each point during over these last 10 years. And that's still because I think that's the easiest thing to do, right? You don't really have to talk about getting good sleep or exercise or nutrition or changing lifestyle. You just go to the health food store, buy another bottle of pills and take those. And it's like, okay, this was easy. So they're still the most commonly used. I think they're actually the one that actually has the most things that probably aren't as effective as all the other modalities. But there are some, you know, herbal remedies and all types of supplements and all types of poultices and all that you can think of that actually do have a role, but we won't talk about those today, thank God. But deep breathing exercises actually were the second most common, almost 11%. This is almost 90,000 people. Yoga, Tai Chi, Qigong have increased since 2002 up to about 10%, and yoga was the most common one used. There's been a small but significant increase in the use of homeopathic treatments. Also acupuncture and naturopathy. The use of chiropractic care and osteopathic manipulation have also increased. And meditation was used by 8% in 2012, keeping it in the top five. So if you look at these, you can almost tell that they're supposed to be in blue, but a lot of these all have to do with mind-body. I mean, deep breathing exercises, that's mind-body. Tai Chi, yoga, Qigong, meditation, all these are mind-body approaches. So they're actually very commonly used by almost everyone in the United States with or without a chronic illness. How about chronic illness and the use of CAM, this complementary alternative medicine? Well, a Canadian health study of over 400,000 people between 2001 and 2005 showed that about 12.5% of Canadians used some type of practitioner and using these type of modalities. The rate was significantly higher for those with chronic illness, such as asthma and migraines, this is two examples. And in other studies, they showed that many of these people who use these different types of alternative therapies don't actually disclose them to their primary care doctors or even their specialists. And with people with chronic illness, you know, it gets more complicated and you have all these things, you have more polypharmacy, you use all these different medications. So it's important to disclose this and ask this because there is a chance of having increased risk of complex drug interactions. We know that CF is now an adult disease as much as a pediatric disease. Advances have increased survival over 50% or so, or greater than the age of 18. And given the complexity and management of tasks required for a multi-system illness, adequate information about the wide array of topics, that's why you're all here today learning about all these things. So, you know, families want to know, patients want to know. Studies have shown that adults in CF, regardless of disease severity or age of diagnosis, and have reported unmet needs for information about their disease. People are really hungry to find out all these different things. This information has included information regarding non-conventional approaches as well. And this was a study that was done of 233 respondents, a median age of 34 years of age, who actually had pretty good lung function, and about 60% were female. And you can see here's just a list of the percentage, the numbers are in percentages on the right, as to what people had questions about. And you can see that new CF therapies, including alternative medicine, was about 30% of people who responded said they wanted to have more information. People wanted to have more information about options for treating CF symptoms, hospice care, how to manage infections, ways to help me gain weight. I mean, that's all over the map. You can see you could actually take this unmet needs and actually make a whole conference out of it just by itself. How about complementary medicine and CF in itself, or integrative medicine? Again, few studies have been documented in using this in children and adults with CF. There was one study, 1992, now that's what, 25 years ago, that 400 patients and families from infancy to 45 years of age were asked about their CAM use, including religious practices, group prayer, physical practices, chiropractic, folk remedies, and other modalities, and that's what was used the most. Other studies have shown that about 60 to 70% of patients reported use some type of alternative medicine, with the most common being group prayer. Again, you have to remember that these are all very regional too, depending on where you're at. If you're in the South, it's different than if you're in the East, it's different than you're in the West or in the mountain range. Everybody has a kind of a different approach about what they might use or not use. But these are older studies now, but we know it's very common. The studies have been reported perceived health benefits associated with this alternative medicine, reduced symptoms, greater emotional support, particularly with group prayer, and no patients really reported any adverse reactions. I hope we wouldn't have any adverse reactions to group prayer. But, you know, actually the whole prayer, people who study prayer, it's actually kind of controversial because, you know, who's praying, who are you praying to, what are you praying about? So there actually it's a very kind of a spirited discussion when you actually talk about people who do prayer type therapies. In a study of children with CF in 2008, about 73% of patients, mean age 11 years, used at least one type of CAM modality, and most frequently was using prayer, and 77% said that was useful. In an adult study in 2014, about 25% of over 15,000 respondents reported using at least one form of alternative medicine. The most frequently reported was breathing exercises, almost 20%, which makes sense if you have a breathing disorder, why not use a breathing type of exercise? It's very common. I mean, you can just go on the internet and just pick up all kinds of different therapies, just about mind-body. You can see there's quantum healing over there by Deepak Chopra. There's Rethink Stress. There's a whole mind-body institute back in the East Coast. Mass General has a huge, Benson Henry Institute for Mind-Body Medicine. And if you look at that middle one, it actually shows you that if you regulate the immune system, actually stress and mind-body therapies may actually help you fight infections, not get as sick as often. Maybe it helps you recover quicker. And our friend Shauna Shapiro over at Santa Clara University has written this book over there on the right about the art and science of mindfulness. It's been shown to be very effective, especially in treating people with psychiatric disorders and psychological problems. So this has also been looked at for all types of therapies as well. So it's very common now, and people have written about it, and they're starting to study it more and more. So what are these mind-body therapies I'm talking about? Well, these are practices like meditation and yoga are among the top 10 complementary therapies, according to that survey I mentioned earlier. So mind-body therapies focus on the interaction between the mind and body with intent to use the mind to influence physical functions and affect the health. Now, we can say like, well, does that make any sense? Well, I can tell you before, about half an hour before I was giving this talk, I was starting to think I was having some pretty mind-body functions on me. I was starting to think my stomach's a little bit upset. I'm kind of getting a little bit nervous. I'm getting a little bit like queasy. And then I just take some nice deep breaths and relax, think about all the nice people who are going to be out there in the audience, actually listening to attendance all over the country, all over the world, and thinking like, well, that actually relaxed me to the point now where I can stand up here and give you this talk. So there's lots of different therapies that are out there. And so it's a big conglomeration of all types of things. There's the cognitive therapies, and I'll talk about those in a minute. That's kind of more the ones that you do that people traditionally have used for lots of different therapies, even such things as stop smoking and obesity and overeating and anorexia. These are all the kind of the cognitive behavioral therapies. There's meditation, which you've heard about. There's the mindfulness-based stress reduction, which Siri just talked about, and how there's a course that you can actually take to the CFRI. Hypnotherapy, guided imagery, biofeedback, and then one that I actually like that people don't think about being mind-body therapy, but actually, how about singing and music and art therapy? And then there's martial arts, including Tai Chi, which people think about being kind of a movement kind of mindfulness, and then things like yoga, which is, actually has to do with strength, flexibility, but also breathing. So just a few, I'm just going to go over a few studies in each of these different areas to give you an idea about what's being done and what's being found. So patients with CF face various psychological issues as a consequence of disease burden and their complex treatment regimen. We all know that's very true. Overall, patients and families have coped fairly well, but there is a subgroup of patients who seem like they have more depression and anxiety. Not common, not for everyone, but there is a subgroup that seems like this is an issue. So what's the current evidence about psychological interventions for individuals in CF and their families? So they reviewed 16 studies with almost 600 participants, and they looked over 1,700 abstracts and titles. And they found a few of the studies were not that strong, but they found a couple that were interesting. One study of massage therapy versus bedtime reading for children and adolescents showed the massage was superior to bedtime reading in reducing parents and children's anxiety up to 30 days on follow-up. So maybe you should read while you're rubbing your child's back. Maybe that's another way to think about it, or listen to some type of nice tape. Although specific intervention studies in patients with CF and core morbid mental disorders are missing, cognitive behavioral therapies should be considered and are likely to improve well-being and adaptations to treatment. This is always an interesting one, and this is maybe a little bit out of the realm of mind-body therapies, but how about cognitive behavioral therapies and diet? It's a struggle, especially in small children and even older children and sometimes even young adults, to really try to keep up your nutrition and really try to take in enough calories. So this is a study of nutritional intervention plus behavior modification on nutrition education. So it was a randomized clinical trial over 9 weeks in a group of 67 CF children, 4 to 12 years of age. And they did it at regular intervals for 2 years post-treatment monitoring changes in body weight. And then they compared them against 346 children they pulled off the registry. And after 27 weeks, the children in the clinical trial group that received behavioral plus nutritional training demonstrated significantly less decline in their BMI scores compared to children in comparable sample. So this study kind of illustrated that behavioral and nutritional interventions is effective and should be considered into clinical practice to help patients live healthier lives. And I think we all can think about different nutritionists you've met in different clinics over the years, and some actually use this all the time. You may not even know they're using it, but they use it all the time. And some just come in and say, like, okay, what are you eating? What are your calories? You should really eat more than this, eat more than that. Okay, thanks, bye. So you really has to kind of do it. How do you actually promote this, and how do you actually bring it to your families and to your patients? This is one of my favorite ones, is hypnosis and imagery. I use this a lot the things that I do, and I'll mention that in a minute. But hypnosis is a state of human consciousness involving focused attention and reduced peripheral awareness and enhanced capacity to respond to suggestions. So if you can actually get away of all the stuff in your side mirrors and really focus on one thing, you can really become more open to suggestion. It typically involves an induction to the procedure during which one's told suggestions for imaginative experience will be presented. So usually, darken the room, you have everybody sit comfortably, maybe you have them sit up nice and straight, and you tend to try to relax to kind of get into this focused state. And this hypnotic state, using one's imagination, may result in a trance-like state. Is everybody in this room, I'm sure, has been in a trance-like state at one time. If you drive to work or drive to school and you don't remember even driving there, you're in a trance. If you watch a movie and you get so ingrained in the movie that you forget you're in a theater, you forget that there's people around you, you forget where you're at because you get so caught up, that's a trance. When I do one of my long runs, people ask me, what did you think about for 50 miles? I said, I don't know. I get in a trance. You know, you get so focused, you kind of just are trying to really kind of think about what you're doing, what your next step is. And, you know, a trance could be, your mind is like a sky, you know, the clouds kind of come and go. Sometimes you have a very blue sky. There's no thoughts. You're just there. Sometimes you have a really cloudy sky. There's lots of things that are kind of coming in and out. These are all different ways to try to get your mind at ease. So one can actually learn to do the self-hypnosis on your own. And we used to do all types of things when I was at the University of Arizona, where we could actually get ourselves into a stance, different types of trance, and we could actually try to even decrease pain and even type of discomfort. And sometimes people refer this to imagery or guided imagery, which is just the hypnosis or trance-like state where you actually have an image that you go to. So if you have something that you really are starting to have a pain with, and you have an image in your mind that when you start to feel this pain, you go to an image that's better or worse, or it changes, then you can actually affect it. And some images you can imagine, I just pulled that I've, over the last several years that people have come up with, is these type of. So you can imagine the one, that koi there on the right gasping for air. You can imagine that's probably not something that people that maybe with a chronic lung disease actually may feel. And this is an image that people have told me. They feel like it's that fish at the top of the water trying to gas that breast. And then what you do, you make it so that that image gets improved. Same way with, I had a patient who told me that they had bad migraines, and the reason they got around that is that they felt like their migraines were like a flower that was really tight, and then the flower bud would open up, and then the migraine would go away. You can imagine, even from this one, what the trance might be, or what the hypnosis or image you might be. On the right, it could be really not that great with fire and brimstone and smoke. This is actually a fire in Tucson a few years ago when I was down there, when the whole Catalina Mountains were set on fire. We watched this every night for almost a month. And then the next type is more celebration. You know, here you have awareness and the more like a celebratory about how you can feel elated and how that can make a big difference. And so these are type of images that you can see. People can go back and forth. Maybe one, you could have the burning in your chest turn into a celebration where now you feel better and liberated. You can imagine all these different things that people have talked to me over the years. You know, an ice pick, Darth Vader, elephant, and a giraffe with a very long neck trying to get the air in and out. These are all images that people have used and use it when they do their mind-body different interventions. So there have been some studies that have been pretty relatively small in cystic fibrosis. There's one in 12 pediatric patients, 7 to 18 years of age, where the experimental group showed significant increase in their peak flow immediately after hypnosis compared to controls. However, the sample size was small, and other factors such as medication adherence wasn't really examined. But they did another study of 49 patients, which almost 90% reported that hypnosis is helpful for them with relaxation, which we just talked about. Improve their tolerance for medical procedures and treatments, which I think is really a very key one you can do. And we've used all types of things like distraction for children and young adults for many, many years for unpleasant procedures, even things as venipuncture. Help cope with different things like headache, which is actually a common, and improve adherence to medication. These are all different things that people have started to show. How about meditation? We've talked about this in a while, but meditation is this practice that uses a quiet location with few distractions. A comfortable position, either sitting, lying down, walking. You don't have to be not moving. It could be a walking meditation, or in my regard, a running meditation for many, many miles. A focus of attention, such as a chosen word or essential words, and an object or a sensation of breath, and an open attitude, I think, which is probably the most important. And letting distraction come and go without judging them. So there's been a randomized controlled trial using 42 mild to moderate asthmatic patients who were conducted using mindfulness-based stress reduction on the quality of life and lung improvement. And they did show that there was quite a bit of improvement in quality of life and perceived stress. It didn't really affect lung function, but you have to remember these are very short studies. And a lot of these studies that I'm talking about for different types of mind-body therapies, you'd have to study them over not 6 months, over a year, but maybe over 2 or 3 or 4 years, or even over several years to see what the effect is. So it doesn't work quite like we do some of our different types of pharmaceutical type of therapies. So it really has to be more prolonged. Tai Chi is one that people are interested in. It's an ancient Chinese tradition which practices a form of exercise. It involves a series of movements performed in a slow, focused manner and accompanied by deep breathing. So again, it's like this moving meditation. It's low impact, minimal stress. Joints make it literally safe for all ages and time, and it actually is a good fitness level. So you can have the very old, the very young, the very debilitated, almost anybody can do Tai Chi. It's also inexpensive. I mean, if you ever go up to San Francisco on any given morning and look at all the different parks, there's a whole groups of Tai Chi all over the whole area, which is very common. And it requires no special equipment. There's an ongoing study now that I just thought was very interesting that I thought I would just bring up to you. Is that the 72 patients over 6 years of age have 8 Tai Chi sessions that are performed home practice with the DVD. They had two groups, and this just gives you a little idea about how complicated it is to kind of design studies for cystic fibrosis patients sometimes. The group A was received one-on-one sessions, so again, infection control and all the things we talked about, so they got one-on-one. Group B was given an online source for their Tai Chi, and each group began with mindful breathing and meditative breathing known as Qigong. The moving meditation helps with the muscle movements, improves circulation and respiration, and mucus clearance was the thought behind this. And at the end of the sessions, they were shown closing methods such as self-massage to reduce tension, improve circulation and respiratory function. And the online sessions for the group B were delivered using webcams and online video, even Skype. And the study results at this time are still have not been reported, but should be out in the next year. So again, this is a kind of interesting way to approach Tai Chi or this moving meditation. And it's thought that it helps calm the sympathetic nervous system and engage the parasympathetic system and helps improve pulmonary function, cardiovascular function, maybe even immune function, and reduces inflammation. So again, these are something that's very simple to do, doesn't take a lot of time, actually can be very health beneficial, help you with your posture and all the other things that we learned about yesterday that can help you with your breathing and your lung function and make a big difference.